domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Centre, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tonnes in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit. Khorasan Razavi province specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechi, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini tubers. So what is a mini tuber? They are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production.
You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a soilless system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production.
As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production. It's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use. Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received three consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress. As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products.
The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy.
Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same two-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high-purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
Well, I'm going to go into a several-minute silence because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you guys a wonderful report. Take it away.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere. Stay with me.
At the start of the outbreak, most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms: oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line.
All right, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, After the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear-cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Now, thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Dema. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Many thanks for that fantastic adventure. That wraps up our program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Regrettably, most Western European countries have aligned themselves with an American-led imperialism that suppresses liberation movements and stifles global dissent. We have taken a look at the world press and media's and news agencies' coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. There is a prevalent belief in the dominance of Western civilization, predominantly materialistic in its composition, despite its contradictory stance towards Islam. This Western civilization emphasizes material wealth over spirituality and morals, often driven by the ambition to assert hegemony and control over both people and their economic and natural resources. This has shaped an imperial system driven solely by the pursuit of power, surpassing moral and ethical considerations. The values it embodies disregard international norms and legal boundaries, operating under a principle that seemingly allows any means to achieve its objectives. Today, the New World Order is epitomized by a barbaric regime that transcends all human norms and conventions to achieve absolute control over people's capabilities. It imposes apartheid-like laws and fosters a view of non-white Anglo-Saxons as inferior, aiming to humiliate them. Regrettably, most Western European countries have aligned themselves with this American-led imperialism, which tramples upon human values, suppresses all liberation movements, and stifles global dissent. A large gap exists between governments and peoples who oppose this hegemony, which is symbolized by multinational corporations, the military-industrial complex, targeted media, Zionist lobbies, and similar entities. Free societies comprehend the nature of this system and its goals, yet they struggle to confront it directly, lacking the courage to resist and safeguard the natural and economic capabilities of the oppressed. The relentless brutality of this racist regime stems from its bankruptcy of values, the complete dissolution of moral systems, and the erosion of beliefs. It exhibits an unfettered approach towards any culture or civilization opposing its dominance, resorting primarily to forceful measures. Amid these arrogant policies, the Western world appears stagnant, surrendering to the law of the jungle, devoid of any glimmer of hope for meaningful opposition. Freedom of speech is suppressed and criticism is muffled. The dominant political forces in Western regimes implement repressive policies without accountability or oversight, while intellectual or military challenges against this global dominance are notably absent. Within this intricate international structure, with its economic, political, and military might, we witness the Palestinian people enduring massacres perpetrated by the Israeli regime, bolstered by the latest military technology and with boundless economic and political support. The Zionist regime historically enjoyed European support and is presently under US leadership, which in turn uses Israel as a strategic ally in the West Asia region to pursue its security, economic and political interests. In light of the objective developments in this new world order, there is blatant support for the Israeli regime's occupation, oppressing a defenseless population whose only crime is their quest for self-determination and the right of return. It has become evident that the ongoing war in Gaza is aimed at undermining the Palestinian cause under the pretext of eliminating the resistance movement Hamas. Under the Zionist regime, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing government, there is no recognition of the two-state solution, the Oslo Accords, or agreements with the Palestinian leadership. Netanyahu's government's agenda has become clear: annexation and displacement to end the Palestinian issue. The impressive demonstrations across European capitals should pressure their governments to reconsider their positions and bear responsibility for the Israeli regime's crimes. The magnitude of these protests will inevitably influence the outcomes of upcoming elections in the West. The Zionist regime's position is perfectly clear: one apartheid regime and complete subordination to this racist regime. The struggle that has gone on for 75 years must materialize into the establishment of a unified Palestinian state, rejecting any possibility of its fragmentation, regardless of the cost. The unyielding resilience and heroism displayed by the Palestinian people has been pivotal in this regard. Western civilization is in the midst of a collapse in its structure, ideologies and moral framework, which has become explicit in its failure to lead the modern world. There must be a profound and dynamic shift towards a civilization that accommodates inclusivity based on equitable justice, fundamental human values and free democratic principles. History is not written by the victor, rather it is inscribed by the people through their revolutions and achievements. Undeniably, the international community is increasingly acknowledging the prospect and practicality of a Palestinian state, with the city of Al-Quds as its capital, particularly in the aftermath of the devastating events of destruction, displacement and loss of life among defenseless Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The sacrifices made are significant and heart-wrenching, emblematic of a people standing up against a brutal occupation.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Axis of Resistance is fighting Israel and its main supporter, the US, on different fronts as the regime continues its brutal aggression on the Gaza Strip. In the besieged territory, the Al-Qassam and Al-Quds brigades are fighting Israeli forces and inflicting heavy losses on them. Scores of Israeli tanks and military vehicles have been destroyed in more than 10 weeks of clashes. The regime's casualties among its soldiers are also increasing dramatically. A report came out earlier this month saying that a total of 2,000 Israeli soldiers have received psychological assistance since the genocide began on October 7. But the rising casualties are not the only problem for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Dozens of captives held by resistance groups have been killed in the regime's indiscriminate bombings of Gaza. On Friday, three of the captives were shot dead by Israeli soldiers. As fighting continues in Gaza, resistance groups across the West Asia region have risen against the Israeli regime. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has been attacking Israeli soldiers and bases along the country's southern border since October 8th, a day after the Al-Aqsa flood operation. Places like Hunin and Beyaz Belida have been repeatedly hit by drones and missiles. The attacks have forced Israel to evacuate several towns and cities near Lebanon. Iraqi resistance groups have also staged hundreds of attacks against U.S. bases, both in Iraq and neighboring Syria, over Washington's unconditional support for Israel. They believe that the U.S. is behind Israeli crimes. According to the Pentagon, American bases in Iraq and Syria have been attacked over 100 times since October 7. At least 60 U.S. troops in Syria and Iraq have reportedly suffered injuries during the attacks. Yemenis have also expressed their support for Palestinians by targeting southern parts of the occupied territories with missiles. They've also targeted several Israel-bound ships in Bab al-Mandab and the Red Sea. The Yemeni army announced on December 9th that all Israel-bound ships would be targeted until the Gaza onslaught and siege continues.
If Gaza does not receive the food and medicine it needs, all ships in the Red Sea bound for Israeli ports, regardless of their nationality, will become a target for our armed forces.
Following the announcement, Danish shipping company Maersk said it would pause all container shipments through the Red Sea. The company said its shipments would be sent on a detour around Africa until further notice. French shipping group CMA-CGM has also halted all shipments through the Red Sea. The Yemeni army's move is reported to have caused huge economic losses for the regime. Israel waged a devastating genocidal war on Gaza on October 7th after the territory's Palestinian resistance movements carried out a surprise retaliatory attack, dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, against the occupying entity over its intensified violence against Palestinians. Now it seems the regime is facing an all-out crisis on different fronts.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in a truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
UNRWA and many other aid organizations have already issued serious warnings about the dire conditions in Gaza. The UN Humanitarian Office also said that Gaza faces a public health disaster due to the collapse of its health system and the spread of disease. Doctors in Gaza are warning about the spread of diseases, especially among children, due to overcrowding and unhygienic conditions of makeshift camps, as well as the lack of medicine and clean water there. The lack of food, clean water, and shelter have worn down hundreds of thousands of traumatized people. And with the health system on its knees, its inevitable epidemics will rip through the territory.
We all know that the healthcare system is or has collapsed. We've got a textbook formula for epidemics and a public health disaster. This is in part, of course, because the shelters have long ago exceeded their full capacity, with people lining up for hours just to get to a toilet.
According to the data compiled by the World Health Organization, from November 29th to December 10, cases of diarrhea in children under the age of 5 jumped 66% and climbed 55% for the rest of the population in the same period. The UN agency said the numbers were inevitably incomplete due to the meltdown of all systems and services in Gaza because of the war. Doctors of the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza have told reporters that the ward was overrun with children suffering extreme dehydration, causing kidney failure in some cases, while severe diarrhea was 4 times higher than normal.
The conditions of the war have led to the spreading of a lot of epidemics and sicknesses, the first epidemic of which has been one of acute gastroenteritis, which we have most frequent cases of in the children's ward. There are a number of patients come with cases of extreme dehydration, some of which can get to the point of kidney failure or weakening kidney function. Things are very bad.
I have 4 children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
Since the truce between Israel and Hamas collapsed on December 1, hundreds of thousands of people have moved to makeshift shelters, abandoned buildings, schools, and tents. Many others are sleeping in the open with little access to toilets or water to bathe.
Children sleep in the tent, while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There's no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets.
Gaza's 2.3 million people now find themselves in a daily struggle to find enough clean water to survive. Residents are forced to take seawater for daily use, despite health risks. The United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly passed a resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Israeli regime's months-long genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. The 193-member Assembly adopted the resolution with 153 votes in favor. 10 countries voted the resolution down, including the U.S., in line with this unfaltering political support for the Israeli regime. The U.S., however, does not hold the veto power at the Assembly, unlike the U.N. Security Council, where it has blocked successive such resolutions. The resolution demands an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, as well as a swift and unconditional release of all captives. It also urges all parties to comply with international law. The vote is non-binding, but is seen as an expression of the views of the international community. It also increases pressure on Israel to end its onslaught on Palestinians. Ambassadors and other diplomats burst into applause at the vote count, which showed much higher support than an October 27 Arab-sponsored resolution that called for a humanitarian truce. Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN urged the international community to decisively address the barbaric crimes of Israel.
One member state, a permanent member of Security Council, misusing its unequal authority of veto power and in clear disregard to the united will of international community, has decided to stand with Israeli criminal regime and materially enable this regime in its ongoing massacre against civilians in Gaza. The United States blatantly opposing a ceasefire, which means prescribing war, violence, and eventually more death for children and women in Gaza.
Meanwhile, Australia, a traditional ally of the U.S., has sided with the UN General Assembly resolution calling for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. It has been described a rare split with its close allies, the U.S. and the U.K.
Australia, alongside 152 other countries, was among the countries which voted in favour. In doing so, we joined Canada, New Zealand, Japan, France and India, and many other countries.
Now, the significance of this vote was that not only is it showing that the support that Israel had from many Western states especially, for its military assault on Gaza is eroding, and even staunch supporters of Israel, like Australia and like Canada, are now saying we need a ceasefire.
World leaders must take a brave and bold stance against those who are fueling the flames of settler colonial violence.
And so what this shows is that Israel is isolated, the United States is isolated. The General Assembly, which is the world's parliament and which is the most democratic organ in the United Nations, has said, we overwhelmingly want an immediate ceasefire. Now, at the same time, and this is where sometimes you feel there's a parallel reality, you hear the United States voting against that, you see the United States voting against that resolution, and at the same time, words from the Biden administration about Israeli indiscriminate bombing.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Climate experts are saying the failure of COP28 summit to phase out fossil fuels and a lack of unambiguous statements from the summit is a tragedy for the planet and for our future. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story. The failure of COP28 summit to call for a phase-out of fossil fuels is devastating and dangerous, given the urgent need for action to tackle the climate crisis, according to scientists. One called it a tragedy for the planet and for our future, while another said it was the dream outcome for the fossil fuel industry. The United Nations Climate Summit ended in Dubai on Wednesday, 13th of December, with a compromise deal that called for a transition away from fossil fuels. The stronger term phase-out of fossil fuels had been backed by 130 of the 198 countries negotiating in Dubai, but was blocked by petrostates, chief among them Saudi Arabia. The deal was hailed as historic as it was the first sighting of fossil fuels, the root cause of the climate crisis, in 30 years of climate negotiations. But scientists say the agreement contained many loopholes and did not match the severity of the climate emergency. The lack of an agreement to phase out fossil fuels was devastating, according to Professor Michael Mann, a climatologist and geophysicist at the University of Pennsylvania in the United States. Professor Michael Mann said to transition away from fossil fuels was weak tea at best. It's like promising your doctor that you will transition away from donuts after being diagnosed with diabetes. Dr. Magdalena Skipper, the editor-in-chief of the science journal Nature, said, "The science is perfectly clear. Fossil fuels must go. World leaders will fail their people and the planet unless they accept this reality." An editorial in Nature said, "The failure over the phase-out of fossil fuels was more than a missed opportunity. It was dangerous and ran counter to the core goals laid down in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, limiting global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels." "The climate doesn't care who emits greenhouse gases," the editorial continued. "There is only one viable path forward, and that is for everybody to phase out almost all fossil fuels as quickly as possible." Sir David King, the chair of the Climate Crisis Advisory Group and a former UK chief scientific advisor, said, "The wording of the deal in Dubai is feeble. Ensuring 1.5 degrees Celsius remains viable will require total commitment to a range of far-reaching measures, including full fossil fuel phase-out." There was a chasm between the stark statement of the emissions cuts needed and the action proposed to deliver those reductions, he said. The COP28 summit text recognizes there is a need for deep, rapid and sustained reductions in greenhouse gas emissions to stay in line with 1.5 degrees Celsius. But then it lists a whole bunch of efforts that don't have a chance of achieving that. The scientists said the loopholes included the call to accelerate carbon capture and carbon storage to trap emissions from burning fossil fuels, an option that can play a minor role at best. Dr. Friederike Otto, a climatologist at Imperial College, University of London, said, "Until fossil fuels are phased out, the world will continue to become a more dangerous, more expensive and more uncertain place to live." With every vague verb, with every empty promise in that final text, millions more people will enter the front line of climate change and many will die. Professor Martin Ziegert, a polar scientist and deputy vice-chancellor at the University of Exeter, said, "The science is perfectly clear. COP28, by not making a clear declaration to stop fossil fuel burning, is a tragedy for the planet and for our future. The world is heating faster and more powerfully than the COP response to deal with it." Professor Mike Berners-Lee, an expert on carbon footprinting at Lancaster University, said, "COP28 is the fossil fuel industry's dream outcome because it looks like progress, but it isn't." Dr. Anella Cantarello, a senior lecturer in sustainability science at Bournemouth University, said, "It is hugely disappointing to see how a very small number of countries have been able to put short-term national interests ahead of the future of the people and nature." Dr. James Dyke, an associate professor in Earth System Dynamics at the University of Exeter, said, "COP28 needed to deliver an unambiguous statement. While the agreement's call for need to transition away from fossil fuels is welcome, it has numerous caveats and loopholes that risk rendering it meaningless. That this deal has been hailed as a landmark is more a measure of previous failures than any step change when it comes to the increasingly urgent need to rapidly stop burning coal, oil and gas." The scientists' comments echoed those of Anne Rasmussen, the lead negotiator for the Alliance of Small Island States Group, whose speech at the closing of the COP28 summit won a standing ovation from delegates. "It is not enough for us to reference the science and then make agreements that ignore what the science is telling us we need to do." Climate science was at the heart of a row that dominated the first week of the summit after The Guardian revealed comments by the COP28 president, Sultan Al Jaber. Sultan Al Jaber said, "There is no science out there or no scenario out there that says that the phase out of fossil fuel is what's going to achieve 1.5 degree rise in temperature." Sultan Al Jaber later said, "I have said over and over, the phase down and the phase out of fossil fuels is inevitable. In fact, it is essential." Dr. Lisa Schipper, a professor of development geography at the University of Bonn in Germany, said, "The early statement by the COP28 president about the lack of science behind phasing out of fossil fuels sent shockwaves to scientists, especially those who had contributed to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the most recent report, since the science in the report is so clear, fossil fuels need to be phased out completely to prevent a point of no return." Professor Mann said, "COP rules needed to be reformed, for example, by allowing supermajorities to vote through decisions over the objections of holdout petrostates and by barring oil executives, such as Sultan Al Jaber, who runs the United Arab Emirates State Oil Company, from presiding over future summits." The French broadcaster France 24, France 24, has also covered the same story. A United Nations climate deal that approved the call to transition away from fossil fuels has been hailed as a major milestone and a cause for at least cautious optimism. But many climate scientists are saying the joyful sentiments of world leaders did not accurately reflect the limited ambition of the agreement. Professor Michael Mann, a climatologist and geophysicist at the University of Pennsylvania in the United States, criticized the vagueness of the fossil fuel statement, which has no firm accountable boundaries for how much countries should do and by what timeline. The agreement to transition away from fossil fuels was weak tea at best, he told Agence France-Presse. It's like promising your doctor that you will transition away from donuts after being diagnosed with diabetes. The lack of an agreement to phase out fossil fuels was devastating. Professor Michael Mann called for a substantial reform of the COP rules, for example, permitting supermajorities of countries to approve decisions over the objections of holdout petrostates, such as Saudi Arabia, and barring oil executives, such as COP28 President Sultan Al Jaber, from presiding over future summits. Mend it, don't end it, he said. We still need to continue with the COP summits. They are our only multilateral framework for negotiating global climate policies. But the failure of COP28 to achieve any meaningful progress at a time when our window of opportunity to limit global warming below catastrophic levels is closing is a source of great concern. The short-term financial interests of a few have again won over the health, lives and livelihoods of most people living on this planet. With every vague verb, with every empty promise in the final text, millions more people will enter the front line of climate change and many will die.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with Iran's sports champions and medalists of the 2023 Asian Games and the Asian Paragames. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh on November 22, 2023. I would like to say a few words to the world's sport officials. They say that sports isn't political, but when they need to politicize sports, they do it in the worst possible way. They come up with an excuse to ban a country from participating in all international sporting events. When someone asks why, the answer is, because you are engaging in a war somewhere. But these same people turn a blind eye to the 5,000 children who have been martyred in Gaza. Sports shouldn't be mixed with politics here, in Israel's assault on Gaza. But there in another place it is clearly politicized and they see no problem with it. They exclude one country from world championships on the pretext of war, while they completely ignore another country and another government, even though it is engaged in war, war crimes, and genocide. They don't ban that country from entering international arenas. That's how it is. Unfortunately, these are some of the world's international problems in sports, and these words are addressed to the world's sport officials. These problems are in addition to the problems of bribes, corruption, injustice, and the world's sports mafia. God willing, these issues must be attended to one day. This was regarding the world's sport officials.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, regarding our own officials, there are many things we need to tell them. I have said many of these things to our country's sports officials in front of the athletes themselves, and sometimes I have said such things to them and higher-ranking officials in private meetings. These need to be followed up. Each of the issues that the Honorable Minister mentioned here should be followed up. The issues that this dear wrestler mentioned here need to be followed up. I say that a strong Iran should be strong in sports. I have previously repeated the slogan, a strong Iran. A strong Iran needs to be strong in sports. Where does a country's strength in sports lie? It lies in them making the right decisions, in choosing coaches, in choosing the right composition in the national teams in all sports fields, and in preventing afflictions in sports. In other words, care must be taken so that afflictions do not hurt the country's sports.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A terrorist group files a lawsuit in a European country against an Iranian civilian. The country arrests the man and keeps him in total isolation on baseless allegations. This is the story of Hamid Nouri, who was illegally imprisoned by the Swedish government in 2019 because of a lawsuit that the terrorist Mujahedin-e-Khalq organization had filed against him. They accused him of involvement in the execution of the members of the group in Iran in the 1980s, an accusation that has not even been proved. Hamid Nouri is called the most isolated prisoner in the history of Sweden, as he has not even been able to meet with his family. In the meantime, Narges Mohammadi, an Iranian woman who has been in and out of prison for committing various crimes against the Iranian nation and the country's Islamic establishment, has sent a letter to the Swedish government while in prison. She has thanked Sweden for putting Nuri on trial.
Sweden is a role model for freedom, democracy, and powerful civil society. Your country hosted one of the biggest symbols of justice for Iran in these years.
Mohammadi, who was awarded the Nobel Prize last week, has been criticized by Nuri's son as she has supported a terrorist group.
Narges Mohammadi is a prisoner in Evin. She has written a letter to the Swedish Prime Minister. Her husband also met with the King of Sweden. She's trying to bolster my father's trial, but she knows well that she's actually helping us with her stupidity, and she's making it clear which is notorious, the Evin prison or Sweden.